Old Laycock then displayed his particular genius, which was that of enthusiastic agreement and subsequent lack of performance.
"That's right, missus. We'll have them Meccasopes there and the Canterburys along the wall. And as you say, it ought to be got on with first thing next week."
Laycock's excuses were always reasonable and strongly resembled those of Captain George's in Three Men in a Boat for avoiding going to sea. In the captain's case, the wind was always wrong, either blowing offshore or inshore, or coming from the unreliable west or the even more treacherous east. Laycock's was the weather. Too dry, too wet, waterlogged, a nip of frost in the air. Or else something of great importance had to come first, usually to do with cabbages or Brussels sprouts, of which he liked to grow inordinate quantities. Laycock's own principles of gardening were simple, and no employer, however knowledgeable, could wean him from them. They consisted of a great many cups of tea, sweet and strong, as an encouragement to effort, a good deal of sweeping up of leaves in the autumn, and a certain amount of bedding out of his own favourite plants, mainly asters and salvias, to make a nice show, as he put it, in summer. He was all in favour of syringing roses for greenfly, but was slow to get around to it, and a demand for deep trenching for sweet peas was usually countered by the remark that you ought to see his own sweet peas, a proper treat last year, and no fancy stuff done beforehand. To be fair, he was attached to his employers, humoured their fancies in horticulture, so far as no actual hard work was involved. But vegetables he knew to be the real stuff of life. A nice savoy, or a bit of curly kale. Flowers were fancy stuff, such as ladies like to go in for, having nothing better to do with their time. He showed his affection by producing presents of the aforementioned asters, salvias, lobelia edging, and summer chrysanthemums.
"Been doing some work at them new houses over at the development. Want their gardens laid out nice, they do. More plants than they needed, so I brought along a few, and I've put 'em in where them old-fashioned roses ain't looking so well."
Thinking of these things, Miss Marple averted her eyes from the garden and picked up her knitting. One had to face the fact. St. Mary Mead was not the place it had been. In a sense, of course, nothing was what it had been. You could blame the war, both the wars, or the younger generation, or women going out to work, or the atom bomb, or just the government. But what one really meant was the simple fact that one was growing old. Miss Marple, who was a very sensible lady, knew that quite well. It was just that, in a queer way, she felt it more in St. Mary Mead because it had been her home for so long. St. Mary Mead, the old world core of it, was still there. The Blue Boar was there, and the church, and the vicarage, and the little nest of Queen Anne and Georgian houses, of which hers was one. Miss Hartnell's house was still there, and also Miss Hartnell, fighting progress to the last gasp. Miss Weatherby had passed on, and her house was now inhabited by the bank manager and his family, having been given a facelift by the painting of doors and windows a bright royal blue. There were new people in most of the other old houses, but the houses themselves were little changed in appearances, since the people who had bought them had done so because they liked what the house agent called old world charm. They just added another bathroom and spent a good deal of money on plumbing, electric cookers, and dishwashers. But though the houses looked much as before, the same could hardly be said of the village street. When shops changed hands there, it was with a view to immediate and intemperate modernisation. The fishmonger was unrecognisable, with new super windows behind which the refrigerated fish gleamed. The butcher had remained conservative,